Hey guys, quick break to tell you about our partners at The Incomologist. They're one of the largest providers of disability and life insurance for CRNAs, and I've actually known the founder for over a decade. We actually worked together at our very first CRNA job. What I love about them is that they are completely CRNA-owned, and everyone on their team comes from healthcare, so they do really understand what we do and what we've gone through to get here, and what actually matters when it comes to protecting your income. I've actually used them myself. Not for insurance, but for financial planning. And honestly, it's been a huge relief having someone that I trust handle my finances so that I could spend more time with all of you. They're independent, so they can shop across top companies and help you find the right fit without any pressure at all. And one thing I didn't realize early on is that with life and disability insurance, you're locking in your health and your rates when you apply. So the earlier you do it, the better, whether you're working W-2 or 1099. They even have some options for you to start in your senior year of school. So whether you're in school, you're about to graduate, or you're already practicing, I definitely recommend checking out The Incomologist. I'll drop a link in the show notes. Welcome to the Atomic Podcast. Whether you're a nurse anesthesia resident in CRNA school or an RN trying to get there, you're in the right place.
I'm Sachi, and along with Rhea, we're going to talk all things anesthesia and science. And we're going to bring along some of our friends, too.
Join us each week as we dive into all things science and anesthesia. All right, so welcome to another episode of Atomic Anesthesia Podcast, where we talk about science and anesthesia education. But a lot of times we like to have our friends on here that have other different types of skill sets. And today we have a really awesome guest, Jake Bevilacqua. And Jake and I know each other from our first job right out of CRNA school, which was a trauma center in New Jersey. And I remember being so nervous starting my first day thinking, gosh, like you just come from being a student to now you're a board certified CRNA. And are people still going to treat me like a student? And so I remember my first couple of days of orientation, actually, I was paired with Jake. And Jake kind of showed me the ropes around this hospital and have mentored and precepted not only students, but a lot of CRNAs transitioning to clinical practice because he's awesome and he's really good at what he does and kind of a trauma junkie, at least at that time you were. So welcome, Jake.
Awesome. Thank you for having me. Did you think at that point when we knew each other back then that we would both be here doing completely different things than we were doing then?
100% not at all. And I remember telling my husband, we joke about this. I said, that is the last time I'm going to school. Do not allow me to apply to school ever again. This is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. And here we both are doing other things. So a little bit about Jake. So Jake actually transitioned to more of a financial role and has his own business. And can you tell us a little bit about what you do now?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was in a CRNA leadership role during COVID, and I realized that, you know, while even in a hospital that takes really good care of their CRNA team, the ultimate goal is always something other than our well-being. It's, you know, productivity, surgeon happiness. It's a lot of other things. And I realized that from that leadership role, what I really, really enjoyed was taking care of my colleagues and looking out for them. And that was not going to be a path to long-term success when I had administration above me who controlled the budget and everything like that. So I was looking for a way that I could put my colleagues first, take good care of them. And it's sort of long story that I won't dive into, but my father has a financial planning business that he's had since the 1970s, wanted me to go into it. I told him I'd rather die than work in an office. It was the most boring thing I could possibly imagine. And then through a long series of events, realized that there are a lot of people who are looking to profit off of us, and they see a professional with a high income and they see us as a target. And there are some that are great and some that really do right by us, but there are also some that have their own interests first and foremost. And I realized that having this loyalty to my colleagues, but also, you know, the opportunity to help them with the financial stuff is really a unique situation because I can really put their own needs first. Because if I need to make some money, I don't need to sell anything. I could just go push some propofol, work a couple locum shifts, and, you know, get whatever I need that way.
Mm-hmm. So now, what is your business model? What do you do?
Yeah, so it's called The Incomologists, and we specialize in the main insurances that CRNAs need. So life insurance, disability insurance, and eventually long-term care insurance. We don't do malpractice insurance or health insurance, but we have other colleagues that we refer to who do that. We help with financial planning, which means different things to different people. For some, it can be a pathway to pay off their debt. For others, it can be balancing their different financial priorities, like saving for their kids' college or retirement. And we also now have a accounting division who does tax strategy, tax planning, accounting, bookkeeping, and that sort of thing. And I am still practicing. Not as much as I used to, but about one day a week I'm in the OR.
Yeah, awesome. How big is your team?
Costa, we have probably, like, in our immediate team, probably about 14 people right now, and it's growing. And then we have a extended team that handles more stuff. But, you know, my goal is I can't be an expert in everything, and no one person on our team can be an expert in everything. And we really wanted to build a team where it's more like an orchestra, where we have, you know, the best trombone player, the best drummer, the best whatever player. I'm not a musician, so it's a terrible metaphor. But I wanted our colleagues to have the access to the best of every discipline, and we're slowly curating that.
Yeah, awesome. So the reason why Jake and I decided to do an episode together is because I get a lot of questions from RNs, from nurse anesthesia residents, and some from CRNAs that ask for financial advice from me. And I was just telling Jake, I'm not the person to ask for financial advice. In fact, when I went to CRNA school, I think I was maybe 23 or 24 years old. I definitely did not have my stuff together. I was definitely living paycheck to paycheck. It was not sustainable. And my goal was always to be a CRNA. So I just kept going along that train and took out the maximum amount of loans, still paying them back, still catching up financially. But a lot of nurses out there, you know, are much more savvy than I am and want to start thinking about financially planning for going to graduate school. We know that you have to take a lot of time off from working full time to go to graduate school. There's a lot of loans involved. How do people best prepare for graduate school? And once you're in graduate school, how do you kind of budget properly? What should you do about loans and living expenses? And then finally, you get your first paycheck, and how do you kind of recover from all that? So I think we'll start with kind of the beginning. So what are some things just overall before we dive into like each kind of like aspect of that? What are some things that people should overall consider as they start to plan for graduate training?
Sure. So quick disclaimer first, this is general advice. This isn't specific advice because everybody's situation is really different. So this is just sort of like general information, not specific advice for any specific person. Also, when you mentioned not knowing much about financial stuff, I was really, really hoping you're not going to ask me any science questions on this podcast. So I feel way behind in
There's
the science.
There's a quiz at the end. Don't worry.
I've definitely forgotten more than I've remembered, and I'm not even sure what a G protein is. So I'm glad that you're on top of that, and together we'll. I'm glad we have our respective disciplines.
This is why I asked for an expert to come on, and not for me to tackle this topic myself.
For sure. So. Let's kind of start just at the very beginning. And that's that I remember I was equally intimidated by the financial aspect of going to anesthesia school as I was the academic aspect. I knew I had, you know, been to college. I knew that, you know, I could, I knew it would be hard, but I knew I could figure it out. I had no idea how I was going to pay for school. I also had no money. You know, I was only a nurse for 2 years before I started school. I was living in Manhattan. It's impossible. I mean, I did not have very much saved to go in, not smart enough to get any kind of scholarship, wasn't in the military. So I was looking at, you know, a very big tuition payment. And I think that there's a lot of things that go into getting ready to go to anesthesia school financially. And obviously the more time you have, the better. And if you're, you know, if you're even considering applying, you haven't applied yet, it's not too early to get started planning. So first thing to consider is just do an inventory of your life, you know. What do you have so far? What assets do you have? How much savings do you have? Just knowing where you're at to start with. And even more importantly, knowing what your support systems are. So for example, I was single going into school. I didn't have anyone to help me out, but I know a lot of people are married and their spouse, even if they don't make a super high income, they do have an income, and that factors in. Other people may have a school that's close to their family and they can live with their family. Different family dynamics are different, and that's not always an optimal situation, but it can be a way to really save tremendously on living expenses. So that's really the first question, is to do a good inventory of what you have and what your support systems are. Second thing is choosing the right school. Now, I think, I don't know, what did you think when you, what was your school choice process like, Rhea?
I only applied to two schools and I only got into one of them. And it wasn't a cheap school. I was with somebody who had just started medical school. So him and I combined, just not a great like financial success combination there. So I went to kind of a more expensive school. But I think at the time, because I was so young, I almost didn't care what the cost was, because, you know, being financially naive, I was like, whatever. For me, you don't see the long-term implications of choosing a school that maybe have lower tuition. So I guess my point is that because I was dating somebody that was kind of tied geographically, I didn't really have a choice. That was where. What about you?
Yeah. So I took the lazy way out and I wish that I hadn't. So I did, the school I went to had a sub-matriculation program where as a junior in their BSN program, you could get accepted to the anesthesia program conditionally, and you could take a couple classes and have it count toward your master's. So I was working in the ICU, really didn't like working in the ICU, wanted to get out and go back to school as soon as possible. And I also really didn't want to take the GRE. And I knew that if I, went to the school I was already accepted to, even though it was more expensive, it was going to be an easier process. Didn't have to get references. I literally just had to prove that I had the requisite ICU experience. Looking back, I mean, it was a great school. I got a good education, but there were other places I would have gone that would have cost a lot less. And I wish I had looked into those. You're right. It's one thing to think, oh, well, this is how much CRNAs make, and I'm only taking out this much in loans. That's like a year of what I'll make. It's not going to be that bad. Paying back loans sucks. Minimize them at all costs. It's not fun. It's going to be harder to pay back than you think it will. And I really, really recommend, like, you know, don't move your whole family to, you know, some terrible state that you don't want to live in and it's going to mess up your whole life. But within your reasonable area that you're looking at, I'd recommend considering a less expensive school.
For sure. And if you are not tied down geographically to any kind of spouse or your kids or anything, consider applying to other parts of the country that have lower cost of living, lower tuition, so that you don't have to take out as many loans to. And you're right. When I got my first paycheck and all the taxes got taken out of it, it was a lot less than I thought it was going to be. I mean, I was like, I'm going to be drowning in money. That was not the case at all. Yeah. And then that loan payment comes in and takes nearly a third to half of your paycheck gone. And then add in mortgage and childcare and all of that, there isn't much left. So each month I was like, man, it'd be really great if I had an extra $2,000 right now, but I don't. Yep. Because of my student loan payment.
Yeah, it's always disappointing when you get that first paycheck that you've been looking forward to for so long. And you made a really good point that I missed too, which is the cost of living. You know, if your rent is $700 a month versus $3,000 a month, that makes a big, big difference. So not just the cost of the school, but also how much it costs to live in that area. So once those things are considered, it just becomes a math problem of how much money are you bringing in? How much money are you keeping? And how much money are you losing in the period of time before you start anesthesia school? And we just work to optimize each of those. So first, how much money are you bringing in? You might have a job you really like in the hospital, but you know that you're going to apply for anesthesia school in a year, the next round, and you know that you're a competitive applicant. If you have a travel contract that offers you double your pay for, you know, a 3-month assignment somewhere, it might be worth taking that. I do know people who have made it through anesthesia school with no loans or very minimal loans. I've asked every single one of them, how did you do that? And every single one has said traveling. I traveled, I took contracts, I worked hard, I went to places I didn't want to go, but I made a huge amount of money and I saved it. So that's probably the biggest nursing hack is doing travel assignments. Because you're physically taking home more money. Then when we look at how much you're keeping, that is how much the money that you're not spending and what you're doing with it. So obviously, the more you can save, the better. This is not a time to get fancy with investments. Savings account, high yield savings account, checking account. The amount of time it's going to be in there is probably not going to make a big difference in the interest. So just something that's not tied up, not in a retirement account, and not in something volatile like the stock market, where you could have it down at a point where you don't want it to be. Last thing is looking at how much money you're spending or your burn rate. If you have a ton of subscriptions, you have a big car lease, you have live in a fancy, fancy residence, you're spending much more money than if you had a more modest lifestyle. It's really, really, anesthesia school is a big enough adjustment as it is. It's even harder if you all of a sudden completely change your lifestyle. So you don't want to deprive yourself right off the bat, but it's good to kind of be like, all right, maybe I'll cancel the subscription this month and ease yourself to the place where you're living more modestly.
Yeah, for sure. And you had mentioned a little bit about retirement, not tying up all that money in areas that are not liquid. But there are people that have put away into retirement. And I had one nurse one time, I remember, tell me, and even at the financially irresponsible 23-year-old me, thought that this was a bad idea. But she said, I think I'm going to take the money out of my retirement and use that. And what do you think about that?
So you get walloped on your retirement money if you take it out. Depends on the type of retirement account. But in general, there's something like a 20% penalty, plus you have to pay taxes on it. So different accounts offer different options. And again, that's something where we look at someone's individual situation and figure out the best option. It's not that you can't do it. It's that it's really, really not my first choice, because I don't want you to lose a big chunk of your money. And even if you take out loans, some cases, that's a better deal than paying that huge penalty on the retirement.
That's how I felt at the time. I'm like, oof. Yeah. I mean, that money can just sit there for years and years and years and definitely accumulate exponentially, but you've taken it out very early on in life when you could just take out a loan. But
And you're completely right, too, that the longer the money is in the account, the more it's going to grow to. And you're not going to have any money that's going to grow, have more time to grow than that money you put in when you're in your early 20s. Because if you start, it's also easy when you graduate anesthesia school to be like, all right, well, all my stuff is broken. I need to replace it. All my clothes have holes in it. Haven't taken my family on a vacation in 3 years. Now I got to pay these loans. And it's really easy to kind of defer those retirement savings. So it's a lot of people don't jump right back into it.
As far as people that have children that are now, I think a lot of this we were talking about, maybe somebody that is single or maybe just dating or, married without children, but now you have kind of like a family to think about and you want to go back to graduate school. Do you have any special advice for those people, for the parents?
Yeah. Well, it raises the stakes for sure, because you have more people depending on you, and not necessarily just a spouse who has the ability to go earn their own income. So in this situation, we look at a couple of things. The first is what does the spouse who is not in school doing? Is their time better spent working and paying for childcare, or is it better spent, actually caring for the children directly if their job doesn't, command a salary that brings them more than it would cost for childcare. Very dependent on the age of the kids, but in general, we like to make sure there's a more hefty emergency fund and a more robust plan, just because there's so much more at stake when you have kids involved.
You can't just keep feeding them over and over and over again.
Yeah. The other thing I mentioned too is that there's the financial aspect of this and there's the academic aspect of this, but there's also the mental health and a relational aspect, and appreciating your spouse and making they go through this with you. They are not physically studying for the tests. They're not getting up usually they are getting up when you get up, but they might not be going through this firsthand, but they are going through it secondhand. And it's really, really important to take some time to appreciate your spouse and, say, hey, things are super crazy, but on Friday night, we're going to go for a walk for an hour. And that's going to be our date time this week. So I think that just being, and I know you, I'm sure, have great experience with this with medical school as well. I'm curious your thoughts on it.
It's been a long road. I mean, both of us have been on an upward trajectory for so many years. It just feels like our normal now. We don't know how to chill. We don't know how to plateau. And even now, my husband's been attending for nearly 4 years now. He's a ENT surgeon. It's the same thing. Like, he just doesn't know how to kind of relax and enjoy life. So he decided to start like a cosmetics business. But anyway, so, you know, when I did decide to go back for my PhD, you're totally right in that it wasn't just me going through the PhD. It was the whole family. There were nights where, you know, especially during the first year, where there's just, you don't leave your office. My husband would bring me plates of food and just leave it there and take the dirty dishes back downstairs. And that was it. He had to pick up a lot financially because we've lost my CRNA salary. So thankfully he was able to, but there was a period of time where he was an associate, not a partner. So he was making less than what CRNAs make. I mean, it wasn't great money. But not to mention just the toll that it took on my children as well. To not see their mother, you know, to see, it was amazing. They saw their surgeon father more than they saw their mother. That speaks volumes. Yeah.
You're a good example of work ethic though.
Well, it really comes down to discipline and definitely, you know, that long-term, what's it called? The delayed gratification, you know, So I think the important takeaway from all of this is setting those expectations with your family from the beginning in all aspects that you had mentioned, you know, with academically, emotionally, financially, everything. Like, hey, things are going to change. It's not going to be we're going out and spending tons of money at the movie theaters. We're going to have like movie at home and we're going to paint our own nails and all those things.
And I think over communication to, like, you know, what you need, where you are, finding out what the other person needs. My wife's a women's health nurse practitioner and I, nurse midwife, doesn't work in the field anymore, but was when I met her. And when she graduated, she was in her second degree BSN, she worked for like a year. And then the day I graduated, like, she started a master's program. I think it was 4 days later, she started her master's program. So same sort of story. And I remember, on the day of her graduation, I had been practicing for a year. She like pulled me aside and she gave me like a present. And she was like, hey, I know this sucked for you too. And so, you know, while I'm being celebrated, I wanted you to have something too, because you went through this with me. And I just, like, I remember that as being so meaningful. And now I try to, you know, share that with people going through the program. Like, there will be people supporting you. Make sure you don't forget about them.
That's a good idea. I think I'm going to take that.
Yeah. It's all yours. Yeah.
It's hard to buy for men anyway, but. I'll definitely.
You know, our standards are very low. But she got me like this cool like fleece jacket. I liked it. It was nothing. Six pack, you know, whatever. it all works.
So speaking of graduate school now, so now you are a nurse anesthesia resident or any nurse in graduate school, whether it's NP midwife or CRNA, you're in school. What are some financial, you know, what's some financial advice that you would give to those people in that stage now?
Sure. Yeah. So the first is, you know, you might have to use loans. Like, we would prefer that, you know, everyone would prefer not to, but, you know, for me, it was unavoidable. And for most people, it is. Try not to get yourself into too big of a hole. You know, having $100,000 in loans is a lot better than having $300,000 in loans. So I had some friends who would take out the maximum amount of loans. They'd go on a bunch of trips during school. They were living in a fancy apartment. I would really recommend not doing that, because you pay for that big time on the back end of that, even though it's a little bit more fun in the short term. So avoiding loans, finding sources of income. Are most programs still like banning work? Is that a thing?
Well, I mean, they have that as part of their... I mean, they might have them sign a contract, but I don't think that any school is really enforcing that. And definitely they're not going to go out of their way to find out who's working and who's not. Yeah. They might look into it more if maybe somebody's super struggling and they're trying to figure out why. And they find out maybe that person is working Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Yeah. So my program, I had to sign a contract, just like you were saying. And it was one of those, like, you'll get kicked out if we find out you're working. And so I didn't work until I ran out of money. And I literally couldn't pay my rent. I remember being in the property manager's office, like, begging her for another week to get her the rent. Literally remember having to put food back at the grocery store, like not being able to like be really sure where my next meal was coming from. At that point, I decided I had to work because otherwise I was in trouble. And working as a nurse is probably the highest paying thing you can do, but it's also very taxing. Like you all know, if you're listening to this, you probably go home from work and you're very, very tired from working really hard as an RN. And it's a hard job. So there are other things, you know, we can do. I have my paramedic certification. So I worked overnights at a quiet ambulance place where I could sit there and study and not have to get up that much. You know, there are some nursing jobs that are pretty awesome, you know, like call jobs, PACU. There are ways to make money to have it fit into your lifestyle, even if it's, you know, renting something you own, Uber Eats here and there. Like there are ways to have an income. And I really recommend having some way to make some amount of money, not just for financial reasons, because it's also nice to connect to something outside of work. I remember really enjoying working as a paramedic because I felt like I knew what I was doing there when I felt like I didn't even know how to put on a blood pressure cuff in the OR. So it was nice to just like get into a different world for a few minutes.
Mm-hmm. I actually babysat in CRNA school.
Really? No way.
Yeah, I didn't have a nursing job and I wasn't going to kind of stress myself trying to get one. So there's no way I was spending my off time working in the ICU being super stressed out. So I was like, one of the CRNAs needed his kids to be babysat. Sure, I'll babysit your kids, you know?
That's perfect. Yeah. House sitting, pet sitting. Think of ways that you can get paid to study. And there's a decent amount of them out there, depending on which area you're in.
Mm-hmm. I think it's becoming easier and easier to make money too.
Yeah.
I think back then, I was willing to do anything. I was like, I'll walk your dogs, especially in that period. And I think you're going to get to this is that period between when you pass your boards and you don't have your license yet. There's a lot of sit around and waiting.
And that's a really important one to plan for because I did not plan for it. I just assumed that I would get my, like, I knew that I had to take boards and stuff and get credentialed, but I just, like, in my mind was like, diploma, paycheck. And there's a long, long time where you have to pay your bills, where you have nothing coming in. Definitely that's an important time.
We were in New Jersey, and I think we waited around for close to 8 weeks before we could even start working. Then there's a lag for your first paycheck. So, it's a lot.
It's not fast.
What other pieces of advice would you give somebody in graduate school?
Yeah, stay away from credit cards because if you rack up student loans at, you know, 6% interest, that's one thing. But if you rack up credit card debt at 28% interest, that's a whole nother thing. You know, if you are someone that really has a ton of self-control and you know that you will only use it for emergencies, fine, have one credit card, keep it locked away, only use it in a crisis. But if you're someone that you think might, you'd be like, I kind of want that and I, you know, don't want to, you know, wait until the next loan disbursement comes in, please just close all the accounts. You're going to get yourself in so much trouble. I see it all the time. It's so easy to do. And it's especially like, it's honest. It's like, hey, I'm in the grocery store and I haven't gotten my next loans and I really want this, you know, whatever food. It's hard, but if you don't have access to high interest credit, you're much less tempted to use it. So that's one. Another thing is like, you know, you have to scale your lifestyle way back. It's usually a big cut in lifestyle. It is not how you're used to living as a nurse. It's living like a poor college kid. And obviously if you have a spouse with a good income, it might not be that bad, but for me it was. You know, I was single until I met my wife, and when I did, she was a student. So it was, you know, it was a it was a different experience. It was humbling, but I also appreciate that time and I use it as motivation at the time. You know, I just remember feeling, I hate this and I never want to feel this poor again. And I really just used it as motivation to get through school. Cause you know, when you're going into your heart rotation and you don't want to be there, it's good motivation. The other thing too, and this is, you know, way off the reservation, but it's a great time to date when you're broke because no one's with you because you're, you know, a sugar mama or sugar daddy or anything. You know, they're not, you know, it's when you're out in practice and you're a CRNA, everyone in the hospital knows that you have good income. That makes you more eligible than you might be otherwise. I'm really lucky that I met my wife our second date. I was like, I really like you, but I can only afford to take you to Burger King. And she was like, yeah, totally cool. And we got the chicken fries and we sat in the drive-thru and like, it was like, you know, I really appreciate that I met her when I had nothing. Cause I know that that's not, she didn't care. She was, you know, she was just happy to, be together. And I think that that's something you lose when your, you know, income goes up. So it's kind of cool to meet someone then cause you know what their intentions are. So.
I have a funny story about that. My, it was the same thing with my husband and I. So when I met my husband, he was working as an EMT driving like critical care patients to the major hospital we were at. And we had met, actually in MRI because he was bringing in a patient that I was, taking over. At that time, you know, he was in the same situation as me, like gearing up to go to graduate school, gearing up to go to medical school. So he lived and still does live a pretty like simple, modest lifestyle where he was driving around a Oldsmobile that at one point got stolen. And, when he got it back, he had to start it with a screwdriver and it, like the key, like that all got busted out. And then he had to keep his car from getting stolen again with a club. And I remember meeting him and I didn't have anything either. And I was like, I really like you. I don't have any money. You don't have any money, but we can keep dating, but I'm not getting in that car. Like that thing looks like a death trap. So I could say, you know, that now that he's doing well as an attending, I'm always like, I was with you from the very beginning when you drove that really crappy Oldsmobile.
You know, maybe that's why he became such a good surgeon, because he learned to start a car with a screwdriver.
He was always handy. He was like into motorcycles and whatnot. So he's like, I was either becoming a surgeon or a mechanic. It was one or the other.
I love it.
So, you know, good. So you're saying good time to meet people. You'll get the honest ones, the people that are not into the lavish lifestyle.
Or, I mean, I guess playing devil's advocate here, they could just be really crafty and patient. I know that you have potential. So it's not foolproof.
Very awesome. A lot of people that you mentioned, and I see it too, like to take vacations when they're in graduate school. I mean, who wouldn't, right? It's such a long road and you need a break, but vacations are very costly. What kind of advice would you say for people who are thinking about doing that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it depends on their situation. You know, if they're married to, you know, someone that's making a great living and it's not going to affect anything, go for it. Have a great vacation. If you're getting by on loans, like I was, and it's, you know, it's struggle time. It's so tempting because you're like, I've earned it. I deserve it. You know, time for a vacation. I've worked so hard. It can really, really derail you. I would probably in advance, like if you have time and you're preparing for it, set some money aside in a separate account for a vacation. So maybe you set aside, you know, $5,000 in your nursing career and your separate fund. And you're like, this is for me to enjoy and relax and have fun during anesthesia school. It just has to be capped and it has to be intentional. And if it's going to blow your budget and you know it's going to cause you more financial stress down the road, it's going to undo all the good that that vacation did. I'm all about relaxation. You have to have it during your program. My former assistant program director, who actually passed away a number of years ago, Russ, he always said you have to celebrate the Hallmark holidays, meaning like all those holidays you see like Hallmark cards for that no one actually really celebrates, like, or in a calendar you see like, oh, it's Arbor Day, or like you have to take time. You have to remember that you're a person. You have to reconnect with your loved ones. You have to relax. But there are ways to do that that are not, you know, really, really expensive vacations. it might be, you know, you drive to the nearest beach and you go rent a little Airbnb there. Just find a way to do it that doesn't wreck your budget. If you, you know, if you're impulsive, it can just cause more stress down the road. And the whole point is that you get through anesthesia school as unscathed as possible. And, you know, it requires a little discipline.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
Do you take any good medications in school?
I
didn't take any.
I actually did. I got engaged before I started school. And then when I was in school, I don't think we ever went on any like lavish vacations. Like we definitely tried to go on some of those like booking.com, pick the cheapest kind of like all inclusive thing and do that. But we actually got married in school. So we put a lot of our extra money towards that. And thank God we got married in school because we didn't have the money to spend on a lavish wedding. So it was a backyard wedding in our friends, you know, our best friend's house. We just pitched a tent and some tables and and hired these like hula dancers, and everybody kind of contributed something. So everything was like a Groupon, like every little like trip we did was like a little Groupon deal or something, you know. But yeah, we tried not to. Even now, we don't go on lavish vacations because we're still trying to kind of, you know, get our retirement together.
And all your free time.
Yeah, exactly. That'll change soon once I'm done with this dissertation. Speaking of retirement, any advice for that?
Don't worry about saving for retirement in school. Like, unless you have tons of extra money coming in, it's going to be a couple lost years, but the increased income that you have from completing CRNA school will more than make up for what you're not saving in those couple years.
Mm-hmm.
And try not to touch your retirement if you can avoid it.
Right. Now people are getting, so now people have passed their boards. They are now a certified registered CRNA nurse anesthetist. They are excited to get their first paycheck. Woohoo!
We already talked about it being disappointing.
Well, maybe things are different now because when you and I graduated, the base salary was probably upwards of $100,000 less than what people are making now. Yeah, don't you think?
I think I started like 130 or something like that. It wasn't much.
Yeah.
It was somewhere in that range.
I came a year after you, right? Didn't I come? You were there for about a year, and then I came.
So it's funny because you mentioned me like precepting. Like I remember that I was there before you, but I just remember you working there. I don't remember you as being like new.
No, you had. I think it was just like the 2 days that you like spent floating with the CRNA.
Like the orienting. Yeah.
Kind of like showing me where everything's at. Yeah. When I started, I was 140. That was the salary at the time, and that was considered on high end of average, you know, probably.
I thought I was rolling in it, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I was like, this is the most money I've made. Yeah. And for what we had at the time, it was fine. But now people are graduating with a lot more money. And certainly if you're taking, you know, locum's position shortly after graduating, you're going to make a lot of money. But regardless, you know, the more you make, the more you get taxed. And so you have your first paycheck. What are some like early career financial decisions that are really smart for these people?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the decisions that you make right out of school tend to have a impact that lasts a decade or more. So I think the first one is which job you take. And there are so many factors that go into it. You know, depending on your financial situation, the actual salary may be more or less important, or the benefits, and that depends a lot on your personal and family situation. But I do recommend being intentional about the job you take and making sure that it's going to get you toward your goals. If you are someone who is in a tremendous amount of debt, getting a locum job right off the bat you'll start off with more money coming in, and it's going to help you pay it off a lot faster. So if you're really in a big hole, I'll usually recommend at least considering a locum opportunity. The next thing is, I think keeping the right mindset, in the sense that there's some people that come out with a mindset of score, I made it, I sacrificed, and now I deserve awesome things because I've been sacrificing for so long and life has sucked for the last 3 years. And while that is completely true, going bananas and buying a house, buying a fancy car, going on lavish vacations, it's not going to work out well for you in the long run. What I recommend is definitely take a jump up in lifestyle. Like, you don't want to be eating SpaghettiOs and peanut butter for every meal like you're used to. You can start going out to restaurants and stuff, but just being measured and intentional with, okay, I've been living on $40,000 a year. Now I'm going to live on $90,000 a year, over double, but I'm not going to spend all my money. And if you do that intentionally right off the bat, it's going to set you up for success long term.
Well, I think some of the best financial advice that somebody gave me coming out of school, some of the older CRNAs would tell me, maximize your retirement contribution from the very beginning and just learn to live without the money. So if you're used to, for example, say you're used to just having $3,000 cash on hand, you never even saw that amount that got pulled for retirement, that 20% or whatever, you just always have $3,000 cash on hand. It doesn't feel like, oh, I'm used to having $5,000 cash on hand and now I'm living with $3,000. So doing that from the beginning helped me put away a lot of money from the very beginning, where I knew what my employer was going to match me and I just maximized what I could contribute. And I did that every single year. So what I would do is I would say, okay, this is what money is left after I've completely maxed out my investments. I've completely maxed out I've paid off my bills. And then I have this pot of money that's left. And I would try to be like, okay, maybe I can treat myself now because I've done all the things, you know?
Yeah. And that's a phenomenal way to do it. And despite being a financial professional, we all have human tendencies in terms of how we handle money. So if I see money, I instinctively want to spend it. But if I don't see money, then I'm like, or the harder it is to get to it, the less likely I am to spend it. So exactly as you said, that one decision, you set the percentage at whatever the max is for your retirement account through work. You don't have to make any other decisions. You don't have to move money. You don't have to use an ounce of willpower. It just happens. And you wind up with a lot of money long term just by doing that. So I'm a big fan of doing the easy things and doing things that are automatic. So what I usually recommend is, dividing your money into, a couple categories. So you have a certain amount of money that you want to save and invest. You have a certain amount of money that you need for your bills, and then everything else you can spend. And when I say save and invest, your financial goal at that time might be loans. So if you have however much you want to save and invest, automatically come out of your paycheck and go to the right place. And you have however much it costs for your bills every month, come out and go to that place or an account that only your bills are paid through. Everything else that comes, you can spend however you want because you know that your savings and your bills are already taken care of. It's a simple system and it lets you set the intention instead of just kind of being reactive and seeing how much is left at the end of the month. So if you get your paycheck and you're like, oh, I'm going to spend these things and then whatever's left, I'll save. There's never any left. So really big. One of my favorite financial books that actually talks in more detail about a system for this is actually by Elizabeth Warren. Whether you agree with her politics or not, totally irrelevant because it's just a financial book. It's not a political book. It's called All Your Worth. And it talks about a very similar system to that. But really, really good read. It's not long. It's not hard. And it's very useful and it's practical.
That's Elizabeth Warren, All Your Worth. Mm-hmm. Now, retirement is not the only thing that we have to be financially concerned about. We need to protect ourselves as well. And especially if you're starting to have children and think about family planning. And a big part of family planning is thinking about insurances and for your profession, malpractice and all those things. Can you talk a little bit about that type of financial planning as well?
Absolutely. Yeah. And this is my, area of expertise specifically. So, thank you for sliding out the soapbox so I can step up onto it. There's offense and defense when it comes to personal finance. So the offense is basically getting your net worth into the positive direction as high as you want it to go. So it's paying off debt, saving and investing. But there are a lot of things that can threaten that. And so we need to have a defense around that to protect our ability to work and grow wealth. So a bunch of bad things can happen. We can get sick, need surgery, have a big medical bill. That's why we have health insurance. We can get sued for, doing something, bad clinically, malpractice insurance. We can hit someone with our car, have something happen to them in our house, which is why we have home and auto insurance. The real ones that are specific to our profession is disability insurance. That's because, especially if you're listening to this podcast, you know how hard it is very acutely to get to the end of the road and become, licensed as a CRNA and start your career. It's a very long road. You sacrificed a lot to get there, and you probably now have a ton of debt, and all of your plans in the future, every vacation you want to go on, retiring, buying a house, taking care of your family, they are all contingent upon your ability to work as a CRNA. We also know from working in healthcare that our bodies are very fragile, and CRNAs are specifically vulnerable because our jobs take fine motor control, both of our wrists, all of our fingers. If you're chopping onions and you slice a tendon in your left thumb, you can't mask someone, can't grip a laryngoscope, you might not be able to practice ever again, even if you're completely functional. So the purpose of disability insurance is to protect your ability to earn an income. So the type we look for our clients is what's called true own occupation, meaning that if they can't be a CRNA, they're not required to do anything else in order to get their disability benefit, meaning that they don't have to go back and work in the ICU, they don't have to work in the PACU, they don't have to do anything. But, we're all type A people. If something happens and we slice our thumb off and our hand doesn't work, but everything else works, we're not going to sit on the couch and watch Netflix until we die. We're going to be good. We're going to find something else to do. We're going to be good at it. We'll eventually make money doing it. True own occupation coverage allows you to make as much money as you want doing anything else, as long as it's not clinical anesthesia, and you can still collect your full benefit. So if you have a $10,000 a month disability benefit, you get $120,000 a year from disability. Let's say you go work as a real estate agent and you make $50,000. You're actually making $170,000 because you're getting the $50,000 from your real estate job and the $120,000 from your disability policy. And even though you're working in another field, you're still considered disabled.
Can I make a comment about that? I don't think that people really understand, when you look into it more, how important it is to have that true own occupation coverage. Now, not all financial planners understand this nuance, because not all financial planners deal with healthcare workers and that's why it's really important to go with a financial planner like Jake and his company, because they really understand how important it is. Because other disability insurances, like Jake said, if you become disabled, they might sit you at a desk to read charts all day, and they'll say, well, you might not physically be able to provide anesthesia, but you have a nursing degree, so you can sit here and read charts and you can't collect on your disability, because you can still do something else with your training. Yeah. Whereas what you're saying is it negates all of that. If you can't be a CRNA, it's nothing.
Exactly. And that's a really good point too, because a lot of the disability insurance that people have through their W-2 jobs is true in occupation for 2 years. And this is, again, in general, not every policy, but most of them. They might say, hey, if you can't be a CRNA and you're not working, we'll pay you for a couple of years. But after that, we have an opening in the ICU. Maybe you can't be a nurse, but we need to have you sit there and watch psych patients. They can put you back to work somewhere else. And if you don't want to do it, you lose your benefit, which is why both for people in a W-2 job and for people who are outside of one, it is important coverage to consider. And my really big thing with this, because we see a lot of people who miss the boat on this one, is the rate goes up every year. But when you start the coverage, that price gets locked in. So if you get this coverage when you're 28, 29 coming out of anesthesia school, this may only cost you $200 or $300 a month. If you wait until you're 42 or something like that, or late 30s, this may cost $700 or $800 a month. And once you start the coverage, your price gets locked in, so you get to keep that price the rest of your career. So the earlier you start this, the less expensive it is. And some people, say, hey, I don't need this because I'm in a job, it has some disability coverage. Then they leave and go 1099, and then they're looking for this coverage at a point where it costs over $1,000 a month. So getting it early saves you a lot of money. The other thing is, this isn't like Obamacare, or health insurance through the marketplace where coverage is guaranteed, the insurance companies get to choose who they insure and they don't have to insure anybody. So they look really, really deeply into your health because if you have a lot of health history, you represent more risk to them and they don't want to offer you coverage because they want to make money. They want you to pay them. They don't want to pay you. They will if they have to, but they don't want to. It doesn't take much to become completely disqualified from getting this insurance. So we have a lot of people who had a breast lump that was, precancerous, tiny little thing. It was excised. It's a non-issue. But now getting coverage is really, really difficult. We see this with, all sorts of conditions. And every single person says, like, I wish I had done this before when it was available. Especially life insurance too, dirt cheap when you're young and healthy, impossibly expensive when you have a medical history. So there's a window on this and none of us know when it's closing. We know we're getting older, but we don't know when the health conditions are coming up. And it's so much better to get this early on in your career. It's easier to get and it's less expensive.
For the life insurance, for me, if you have a spouse or a child, especially children, it's a non-negotiable. And I have met CRNAs whose spouses have died and have not had life insurance. And now it's just you, and you have a family to take care of and you've lost that second income and nothing to back you up. Non-negotiable, definitely get it early. The nurse comes to your house, draws some blood, has you pee in a cup, and that's it. And the life insurance is cheaper than the disability insurance in general, depending on how
it's like. I mean, you can get good life insurance for the cost of a couple pizzas a month. Depending on how much coverage. And it's not life insurance, it's love insurance, because if you care about your family, unless you have some other source of wealth, exactly as you said, I think it's a non-negotiable. We've had situations where people have died without it and it's financially catastrophic, and a spouse, may be forced to go back to work when they really wanted to just stay home with their kids, because they've lost their partner. And we've had other situations where people have had good insurance, and it's just been a complete game changer because while the family's devastated, they're set up financially and they have the space to grieve and they have the space to take time and they have the space to set their life up in an optimal way going forward.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting that you mentioned just even one tiny, tiny little medical thing on your chart can jump up your rate. I remember when my husband, we got our blood drawn and whatnot. He has some very, this is actually a normal thing where some men will spill protein in the afternoon, but not the morning. It's a normal thing. And I don't even know what it's called. It's not even a condition, but when they took his urine in the afternoon, they saw he had really, really high protein in his urine. And they said, oh, this could be a sign of this, of course, these are some of these people are non-medical people. They're like, oh yeah, he has signs of kidney disease. And his rate went from I think maybe 150 to 200 to 800 just because of that one little, and you're like, what? This is not even a diagnosed medical condition and you're going to increase the rate. Yeah. He begged them to come back and redo his urine in the morning and it was miraculously gone. So something little.
It's a good thing that, you guys have a medical background. Part of what we offer in our company is that we're all clinicians. So we know these things this person's heart rate is 49. When the insurance company says, oh, they have bradycardia, we're like, yeah, but they're an endurance athlete. There's a reason for this and it's good. So we get a lot of joy out of fighting with the insurance companies over medical things. So.
They're the devil. Oh my gosh. So yeah, always a benefit to work with a clinician who also is in the financial world. Other things that new clinicians should worry about financially or think about?
I think that just you will be approached by an array of financial professionals who are excited to work with you because they will make money off of you. And that's not inherently a bad thing. Any professional should be paid for their services. But I would listen to your gut and I would consider cross-checking the information they provide. There are a lot of people out there that are absolutely phenomenal, will do right by you, even, to their own detriment. A lot of really good people. but also some people who may think they're doing the right thing, but it's really more for their own benefit than for yours. So if you get some advice, especially if it's buying something expensive, especially if it's like a whole life or a permanent life insurance product, or they call them IUL, they go by different names. If they're trying to sell you something that seems really expensive and you're just not sure about it, look online, just do some Googling, talk to someone else. You're welcome to reach out to me for a second opinion. You know, just before you commit to something that seems really expensive, just make sure that you check around a little bit and make sure that what you're getting is what's best for you.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So kind of in summary, what is the, you know, if you could put something in a prioritize things, put something in a put things in order from maybe that top priority to maybe a lower priority, what would you say people should focus on?
Sure. Are you talking about out of school, like new in practice?
Yeah, new grad, yeah. Out of school. What's the first thing they should do? And then go to the last.
I would say number one is have a plan. Have a plan and a budget. Because if you're proactive, it's going to turn out much differently than if you're reactive. So if you say, okay, this is how much I need to set aside for bills. This is how much I want to save. This is how much I want to increase my lifestyle by. This is my budget. This is my plan for doing it. Then you're going to do great and you can just make tweaks. But if you start the way I did, which is like, ooh, some money came in. Let me put some here. Let me put some there. And I'm going to buy this. And it just doesn't work out. And you're going to be making enough money that it's going to matter whether you have a plan or not. And in terms of debt payoff, there are different, that's a whole other topic in and of itself. But there is nothing wrong with aggressively paying off your debt, even if you delay your savings a little bit more. I'm a big fan of getting rid of student loans.
Have you paid off your student loans?
Yeah.
How long did it take you?
So Amanda and I graduated with $436,000 in student loans between a bunch of degrees, between the two of us. We weren't irresponsible, but we kind of just like pushed it into the background. I think our monthly payment at that time, like in total, was like $4,000 minimum. And we were looking at buying this house. It was like a tiny house. It wasn't like anything fancy at all. It was like 800 square feet. And we like looked at the finances. We're like, oh, we can't afford this. And we both had a six figure income at that point. And we're like, wait, why? I thought we were rich. I thought we were doing great. Like, why can't we afford this tiny house? And we kind of like peeled back the layers and we're like, oh, we're in overwhelming debt. And it was sort of the point where we're like, oh, do we have kids or not? And we're like, we can't buy a house where like we're paying our bills, but we don't have much left. Like we really can't and shouldn't do anything. And we got super upset for a while and then kind of, you know, figure out that we needed to get rid of the loans, and we got on a plan. It was really, really hard at first, really, really slow progress. And then it just snowballed and it took maybe 3 or 4 years. And there was a lot of sacrifice, and it was really hard because we had both been in school for so long and we wanted to just have fun and we wanted to go on vacation. We wanted to do all the things we saw our friends doing. But we're like, you know what? Let's just like grit our teeth, suck it up. And you know, this is worth it in the end. And I guess if like we had died during that time, it would have been a terrible decision. But we luckily made it through. And looking at our life now, the decisions we're able to make are completely different because we need so much less every month. I would rather have money in the bank than anything fancy. Like, I do not live in a fancy house. I do not drive a fancy car. And there is just as much wealth and power in having low monthly expenses as there is in having a lot of money and stuff. Because the less you need, the less you need. So long story short, paid him off. Glad I did. Sucked while we were doing it.
Perfect. I know a CRNA that she's about to start her PhD. So that's how we met each other, because she wanted some mentorship for that. But she, out of school, her and her husband lived in a camping van for a full year while she traveled and aggressively dumped into her loans, and she paid them all off in 1 year. And talk about sacrifice. I mean, she didn't even have a house, really, you know, just lived in a van. Yeah. And she's same thing. She's like, best decision, learned to live with very little, don't need a lot. Yeah.
It was absolutely worth it. And not just for having the loans paid off, but it helped us to learn how to communicate about money. And it got us completely on the same page. It was a great like marriage thing, just working together through something really hard. And you know, I would do it again in a heartbeat, and I'd recommend it to anyone else too. You know, it's just a life is just different when you don't owe anyone money.
Yeah. I actually, I will say I got kind of lucky. I always told my husband things will always work out in the end. It's okay. And he's like, you're absolutely out of your mind. But one of the reasons why I picked the hospital too, that I, right after school was that it was a nonprofit, and I purposely always chose working for companies that were nonprofit. And so this summer, I will have, all the loans forgiven through public service loan forgiveness. So
there
are other ways, and it's about $325,000. So it's a lot of money. There's going to be people out there that listen. They're going to be angry that I didn't pay it. I don't care. I made the decisions that I made so that I could qualify for something like that.
And you've also paid a lot into it in interest. Like you've probably paid up, close to that in just interest payments over time.
Absolutely. So there are other ways. There are other, health service loans out there. People are giving out massive sign-on bonuses. Don't blow that. Yep. Use that towards your loans. So there are other things out there for people to take advantage of, for sure.
Yeah. I will caution, though, the bigger the sign-on bonus, the worse the place it is to work. Not 100%, but do you think there's merit in that? Do you agree?
There's a reason why they're CRNAs. There's a reason why they're because if they were fully staffed and they had no problems getting people, then they wouldn't be offering crazy amounts of money. So I think there probably is some truth to that. You know, if the place is a revolving door, that's a red flag. If a place is hard to get into, keep trying to get into it.
And I think also there's a lot of temptation as a as a student to think that an amount of money is the most amount of money in the world. I remember I got a paycheck for my paramedic job for $246, and I was like, I'm rich. Like, this will get me through the rest of the month. So if you say to someone in school, like, I'm going to give you $50,000 if you sign on here for 3 years, that's very, very tempting, especially if you can access that money like before you graduate, when you're like, that would be life-changing. I would really, really caution you to not commit for a long time, definitely not more than a year or so, especially for an amount that's a fraction of what you're going to be making in a year. Because while that's, absolutely life-changing money when you're in school, when you're 2 years into that three-year commitment and you're locked there and you're making $50,000 in, 2 or 3 months, it's a decision that you might regret.
For sure. I mean, if you parse out $50,000 over 3 years, honestly, that's just a couple of overtime shifts. It's, at a different hospital. So you might be right. Don't lock yourself into a culture that is not a good fit for you. So awesome. I think that was a lot of really good information. And I know that a lot of people are going to come back and ask more detailed questions. So certainly if people have more information or more questions and want more information from you, where can they reach you and how do they contact you to get more financial advice?
Sure. Yeah. I'll give you my email and you can put it in the show notes if that works. And anyone's welcome to email me.
Yeah. And can people, if they want to access the Incomologist, do you have a website that they can go on and get more information?
Absolutely. Yeah. I'll send you that as well. So that can put a link there. Yeah.
So we'll link that in the show notes. Awesome. So thank you so much for your time. I think that people are going to get a lot of benefit. And like you said, just as important as the academics is your financial success. I think that finances definitely cause a lot of stress for people, but when you get it under control, it can be really, invigorating, and you feel like you have a lot of control over your life.
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly a component of wellness, and really grateful for having me on. It's an honor to be on a podcast that Alex Gorman was on.
Do you guys know each other?
Yeah, I presented him when he was a student up in Massachusetts.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah. He's great. He's actually going to hop on some more cardiac stuff as well. That's hilarious.
I would say he was like I think I would have let him anesthetize me like as a junior, like 4 weeks into his like first rotation. I would have been like, hey, you can do anesthesia on me. Like
I've never seen him do anesthesia, but I bet he's freaking excellent.
He is naturally an amazingly fast learner, both technically and didactically. Just one of the sharpest, brightest, amazingly talented, which is like one of the most phenomenal clinicians I've ever seen. And this was as a student. I've never even seen him in real practice, but, he was an incredible student.
That's the great thing about our profession. One of my favorite things about our profession is our community. And we all know each other. We're all like literally one person removed from somebody else in the profession. So that's awesome. Well, thank you so much, Jake.
Yeah, of course. It was such a pleasure, Rhea.
All right. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.